This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Today's episode 87 of Feast Your Ears. We're enjoying wonderful fall weather here in New York, and I couldn't be more excited today to talk to Robin Eckhart. She's the author of Istanbul and Beyond, Exploring the Diverse Cuisines of Turkey. Came out last week, and it's an absolutely beautiful book. It is as much a travelogue and a love letter about the Turkish country and people as it is a cookbook. Her husband, David Hagerman, shot the book, and the photographs are incredibly mouthwatering and make me wish that a year in Turkey was on my horizon. Thanks, Robin, for taking time to join me.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you don't mind me saying so, but in reading your book and reading your blog, I feel like you're kind of a Diana Kennedy of Asia.
That's a real compliment. Incredible.
You know, people who are listening who know Diana, she, you know, has spent her life's work has been exploring the cuisines of Mexico. And, you know, I feel like that is sort of what you've done for Asia. You know, your website is eatingasia.typepad.com, and right. It is a 12-year running blog about your life living in and traveling and eating and cooking in Asia.
Yep, exactly.
Which, you know, for a Westerner, you know, I think there's a lot of people who out there who now are interested in Asian food and interested in those ingredients. And we all, you know, those of us who are interested in those things fantasize, I think, about going to live there. But you've done it, and you've documented it incredibly well and beautifully.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks. Can you tell me a little bit about what led you to move to Asia? You grew up in the Midwest.
I did.
And, you know, in Michigan, and then spent some time in Northern California.
Right.
I also have a soft spot for Northern California.
It's a great place.
It is a great place. They're a little rough right now. A lot of my friends from my time in the North Bay are dealing with some awful fire stuff
awful.
Now. But what led you to move from the United States and to, you know, to go to Asia?
Well, as an undergrad at Michigan State University, I started as a pre-veterinary med student, and much to my father's chagrin, switched to Chinese history after a class taught by a charismatic, great professor. And so after I graduated from MSU, I went to Chengdu, Sichuan province, as their first student to study Chinese. The Chinese program was not good, to say the least. I'd already been studying for a couple of years, so I switched to teaching English. And so I ended up staying in Chengdu for a year. David, my husband, joined me after a half a year, and he also taught English there. And that just sort of was the nub of our blossoming love of Asia. We went back after graduate school. He got a job in Hong Kong, and I, by then, was working on a PhD in Chinese politics at UC Berkeley. And from there, it just continued moving up to China and then into Southeast Asia, Bangkok and Vietnam and KL.
And so pretty much ever since, you've called that area of the world your home?
Yeah, until recently.
Yeah. it's amazing, and you make it sound very easy, that it was just one thing flowed into the next, and you decided to...
It was lucky. You know, that's what it was. Luck and serendipity and sort of working a little to get ourselves there.
Yeah.
But in the end, it was a lot of luck.
Yeah. You mentioned to me in some conversations before the show that it was really there that your eyes were open to all these different foods and these different flavors that we, you know, don't really have, at least not in the United States. Maybe there's some stuff in Europe. I feel like, you know, you get fish sauces in Italy and things like that.
Right. I mean, I grew up in the Midwest, as you noted, in Michigan, 1970s childhood. Classic dinner was, you know, starch, veg, meat on a plate with maybe a salad or cottage cheese and canned peach half on the side. My mom was a very good cook. She grew up in Arizona and California, and so we had things that other people in my neighborhood weren't eating, exotic things like avocados and artichokes.
Sure.
But when I went to Sichuan, it was in 1984, and there was no Western food there. Yeah. You went to Beijing if you wanted a hamburger. And it was either because it was a sink or, you know, sink or swim situation where it's like if I wanted to eat, I had to eat what was there, or there was this as yet undiscovered love of different flavors in me that just blossomed there. So I just immediately took to everything: fishy flavors, prickly ash, chilies, more and more chilies, and I think it did turn me into, you know, for lack of a better word, a foodie, someone right. who just lived to eat.
Right. And that's so clear in your blog that it is about the travel mm-hmm. as well. I mean, and one of the things I love is that in your posts, I mean, this morning I was reading your post about drinking coffee in Hanoi mm-hmm. and how, you know, there's always good coffee. So it's easy, even though you're tired from traveling, to get up early in the morning because mm-hmm. you know there's going to be good coffee when you walk out of your hotel, and there's going to be good coffee 2 hours later, and there's going to be good coffee
or
2 hours
10
after
steps
that.
Down the block, and it's iced, and you're hot and sweaty. So right. What better thing is there than iced strong coffee?
But also, you know, some of David's photographs in there are not just of the coffee. I mean, you get a very clear sense of what it's like to be in the coffee shop with the locals who are there drinking it,
right?
Which makes it much more than just about coffee. It's not about the taste of
the
coffee.
Because it's like a coffee culture.
I mean,
it's coffee culture, you know, just in the way that there's wine culture in Italy or in Georgia. And, you know, it's been said before by many, many people, but food is such an entree into local culture. It's easy. It's accessible. It's non-political. It's non-controversial. Well, kind of. Yeah. You know, if you love to eat, if you love to drink, you will find your way in a new culture.
Absolutely. I mean, it is, and it's also a somewhat universal language. If you don't speak the language, you can still come in. And if you come into the coffee shop and you look inquisitive and you point at something, they're going to know that that's what you're there for.
Yeah, right? Sure. And they'll work with you.
Yeah, of course. you know, I'm reminded of the first time I went to Japan. I spoke almost zero Japanese, and Google Translate, which now, for those of you who are going to Japan, is an incredible tool there, because the language barrier coming from America is huge, didn't exist. And so I spent a lot of time just pointing and smiling and had a great time. I mean, went to a number of incredible restaurants, had no idea what I was ordering on the menu. I pointed at other people's plates. I learned how to say, I would like that, please, because mm-hmm. I wanted to at least, you know, I want to be nice
Important
about
phrases.
It. I learned how to order coffee, and I learned how to order beer. Those mm-hmm. were the two first things I learned
Very
to say
important.
In Japanese. You know, what are those the kind of things that you would recommend to people who are traveling in these places where, you know, I feel my sense of traveling when I've traveled in Europe is that in a lot of the places you go, there's going to be some understanding of English.
Sure.
You're going to be able to get by,
sure.
you know, whether, even if, you know, the French waiter might like turn his nose up at you but he's still going to understand you and bring you food and whatever.
Right.
You know, but if you're getting into, you know, a tiny little coffee shop somewhere in, you know, Sumatra, you mentioned having coffee
right.
and tea there, you know, are those people going to understand any of the language, or is it really about the pointing and the gesturing and the smiling?
I think the smiling is very important. Be unafraid, be curious, always smile, because if you are unsure and you don't smile and you feel embarrassed because you can't speak, people pick up on that and that makes them nervous, you know? And be unafraid to make a fool of yourself. Play charades.
Yep.
Walk around the restaurant, you know, pointing at people's food like, I like that. And people generally will be so thrilled that you're making an effort and they will work with you, yeah. I've found.
So let's talk a little bit about the book. You know, Istanbul and Beyond is the book, and it's, you know, as I said earlier, it's beautiful.
Thank you.
I've made a couple of recipes out of it.
Oh, great.
Delicious.
I saw that
yeah.
on Instagram.
and, you know, so after all of this time, I mean, you've spent, you know, you've spent at least 12 years writing and with David photographing foods in Asia, mostly Southeast Asia. What led you to Turkey?
Okay, well, a circuitous route. Dave and I were living in Shanghai in the late 90s. I was working on my dissertation, and which I never finished, by the way, but I did do field work in China, and Dave was working a corporate job there. And we had been in China for 3 years, and we just needed to get out. We had Chinese New Year's. It was a three-week window of opportunity for travel. We had frequent flyer miles that would get us to Europe. Europe was too expensive for us. So a friend said, why don't you just go to Turkey? And it was February. It was Ramadan. We didn't know, you know, that from anything. But we did get tickets on Lufthansa for free. And we went to Turkey and we spent 3 weeks. And it was strange. I remember driving in from Ataturk Airport that first night. We got there after midnight and driving past the Blue Mosque, and it was lit up and there were stars in the sky, and it was very cold out and it was a brilliant clear evening. And I don't know, there's just something, you know, without using the word exotic, it was just completely different to anything I'd known or experienced. And from the next day, we just loved Turkey. We spent 9 days in Istanbul, and then we flew to Izmir and picked up a car and drove east through Konya, and then south to the Mediterranean. And it was just a fantastic experience. And when we left after that trip, I said to Dave on the plane, I distinctly remember saying this, I don't know how, I don't know why, but someday Turkey is going to be a big part of our lives. And we moved back to Berkeley later that year, and I started studying Turkish at Berkeley. And coincidentally, my Turkish teacher was Ayla Algar, who's written two Turkish cookbooks. Yeah. We went to Turkey back and forth, didn't go for a while after moving to Southeast Asia in 2002, and then went back in 2010. For the first time in a long time, and thought, you know, are we still going to love it? Was that a situational thing? Whatever. The moment we landed in Istanbul, we were both just like, oh, we love this place. And by that time, we were both freelancing, and we had a way, and we had the time to work on something in Turkey, and the book is a result of that.
And I mean, the book really covers. I mean, you know, I had, you know, some sense of like vaguely what Turkish meant, at least to me as an American, you know, felt very Middle Eastern with the maybe a little bit of Balkan influence. But really had no understanding until I looked at the book about how vastly different the different regional cuisines are. And
right.
That there are areas that are known for their wheat and areas that are known for their cheese and areas that are known for their, you know, for their fish. I mean, they know that it really has that regionality.
Yeah.
That I think as an American, we've come to understand those things about places in Europe.
Exactly.
Because we have a long history of trade with Europe, and we have a long history of European immigrants that have influenced us here.
Right.
And I think once you get to the more modern, I mean, we're living in this really weird time related to immigration,
yeah.
Especially from that part of the world where even if you are open to it and you are on the what I consider the right side of it, and
right.
You want to welcome these people in, they understandably in some cases are relatively closed off in this country because they have their communities, and it is sometimes hard, I think, for us to,
exactly.
to sort of break into that and come to understand that, because sometimes those people need to be, for protecting themselves, a little bit skeptical,
sure.
of, you know, a white guy who comes into their restaurant or comes into their, you know, although I do find the same thing is true. It's at least in New York, you know,
definitely.
The same thing is true. I mean, New York is a wonderful melting pot. And so you can go and sort of seek out these restaurants and these places and have a great time and smile and, you know,
right.
And talk to people and eat some of this wonderful food.
I think the thing with Turkey that surprised us was just how welcoming people were. I mean, you were talking about the incredible diversity, and I think that's something we discovered or learned ourselves on our first that trip back in 2010. We spent time in Istanbul, and then we picked up a car in Gaziantep and drove for 3 weeks north and east to the border with Iran, and then up to the border with Armenia, and then back inward. And we were just blown away. I just, you know, we'd traveled a fair bit in Turkey by then, and it was just like, I'd never heard of any of these foods. Why haven't I heard of any of these foods? And also, what, you know, people are just opening their doors to us. They're inviting us in for tea. They're inviting us into their kitchen. They're, you know, asking us to come and hang out in their bakeries. And I think at that moment, it struck us both, you know, A, like, people need to know about these foods, and B, we could actually do something like this here because people are so very eager to share their culinary traditions. They want to share it.
Well, it's so clear from the book and from reading the recipes and having made some of them that it's home cooking.
Yeah,
right.
It's absolutely.
Not this is not coming out of the Escoffier, you know, world in France and in Italy and in restaurants and, you know, molecular gastronomy and those things. I mean, you know, I think the imam cried, right?
That's imam fainted.
The imam fainted, you know, eggplant dish that I made last week or the week before. You know, I mean, there's like 6 ingredients, maybe. I mean, it's not that much in it,
and not weird ingredients.
No, and it's
by the American standard.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And it wasn't hard to make.
No.
But it was not a type of eggplant dish I'd ever cooked before.
Yeah, I mean, that's the amazing thing is, like, in so many instances, I think I capture that in some recipes in the book. It's familiar ingredients, familiar to the American cook. They're just used in different ways that produce a flavor that we never thought of, or ingredients like tomato paste that aren't used for, you know, to thicken a sauce, but actually to lay the base for a sauce.
Yeah.
Because something that was brought home to me that I never really thought about while researching the book is, like, so much of what we eat now, so many ingredients that we use, were developed as a way to preserve agricultural bounty. So for me, an American growing up in America, tomato paste was just tomato paste. Going to Turkey, you see people with piles and piles of tomatoes making tomato paste in the fall because they live places where there are no fresh tomatoes in the winter.
Right.
And this is a way to carry that, to have a taste of tomatoes in the winter. And so they use those ingredients differently. It's not to add a flavor. It's like the base of a dish.
Right.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors. And when we come back, we'll continue to talk about Turkey and Istanbul and beyond.
Okay.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum, and today, if you're just joining us, I have Robin Eckhart here in the studio. Before the break, we were talking about her book, Istanbul and Beyond, and talking about Turkey and Turkish food and traveling in Turkey. Robin, are there ingredients that you come across or came across in your travels or in some, you know, we were talking before the break that a lot of the recipes are very easy. I mean, there are ingredients that we know in the United States that are easy to come by.
Right.
Are there any ingredients that are a little bit more of a challenge, but that you might suggest people do seek out?
Sure. I think you can get most of the ingredients in the States. The difference might be the quality of ingredients. So I think by now a lot of people have been turned on to the wonders of pomegranate molasses.
Sure.
It's an amazing ingredient. It's worth seeking out. But there's a difference between mass manufactured pomegranate molasses, which contains things like glucose or things to sweeten it or thicken it, and the artisan stuff, which is really simply, I watched it being done in Hatay province, pomegranate juice boiled down until it's thick.
Yeah, I mean, when I was reading about that in the book, I thought, oh, it's like maple syrup.
Yeah.
Which I'd never made sort of the connection that
yeah.
you would make it the same way. Of course you would. Of course you'd just boil it down to thicken it, and it would caramelize some of the sugars.
I'd say think of something like pomegranate molasses the way you might think of olive oil. Okay, for maybe for salad dressings that have other ingredients in them, you don't need the very best of the best. You just want that little hint of fruity citrus. But for other dishes, maybe you do want to spend a little more on a really nice pomegranate molasses that you can order from a place like, I think, Nar Gourmet, which sources things in Turkey. A bottle might cost you $12, but you're not going to use, you know, glugs and glugs of it. This is for right. when you use a teaspoon for it. Or a tablespoonful.
And I think even, you know, I mean, in the food world, I mean, $12 for a bottle is not that much when you consider what people are spending on things like balsamic.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So.
Another ingredient I really love is mahlep, which is the ground in kernels from the seed of a certain type of wild cherry. And it's been compared to vanilla or been called the Turkish vanilla. It just has this very sweet, warm scent that adds something really nice to baked goods, and you have to use it in very small amounts because if you use too much, it makes the whatever you're making bitter. I have one recipe for a Syriac Christian spice bread in there from Mardin province in the southeast, and it uses mahlep. And I say, you know, if you can't get the mahlep, which you actually can order on, like from good spice stores, just leave it out. Don't substitute vanilla.
Right. So it's not worth making that substitution.
No.
It's hard to research Turkey. I mean, you know, in any time you, if you go to Google, which we all do probably, you know, more times a day than we probably should, instead of picking up the phone and calling someone who might know about something or emailing somebody, if you look up Turkey, you don't find anything really about the country, right? Because we, as a country, to us, Turkey is related to this large
bird
that we cook once a year.
Yeah.
So, you know, aside from your book and your website, are there other resources where you would point people if they're interested in delving further? Just because a quick Google search is not going to yield much. Even, I tried this morning, I said, okay, I'm going to look up Turkish. And I was looking up for articles about Turkish, gourmet food, I think is what I used as a search. And it still comes up with things about Turkey.
Yeah, there's a few places. The Turkish Cultural Foundation has a website devoted to food. And I can't remember exactly. It's something like turkishfood.org or something. It's an org. And there's a lot of interesting info about food traditions and foods that people might not know about. The website culinarybackstreets.com, they started in Istanbul, they were originally Istanbul Eats, is a trove of information about food in Istanbul and beyond. And there is a Turkish journalist, food journalist named Aylin Onetan, and she writes for one or more of the Turkish newspapers, and I can't remember which ones, but if you Google her, Aylin Onetan, you'll come up with a lot of great information on Turkish food.
Excellent. Thank you for the recommendations.
You're welcome.
I want to talk about anchovies.
Yes, please.
So you wrote an article a couple of years ago in the Times
right.
about this kind of, I don't know, anchovy pilgrimage
right.
that you went on, which to me, when I started reading it, I thought, oh man, if this could just be my life.
When
I was 19 or 20 in college, a close friend and I cooked up this idea one night. We were two of very few people, in our sort of friend group who actually liked to cook mm-hmm. a lot. And we were cooking one night and we cooked up this idea. At the time, it was before, you know, you could get paid to write an article for the internet. So we cooked up this idea to write a book. And our idea was, let's drive all of Route 1 on the east coast of
yeah.
America and all of Route 1 on the west coast of America
yeah.
and do a book that's like two halves
oh,
about
yeah.
the food
oh,
along the drive.
That's a great idea.
And we never had anybody to buy it or anything, but that was this idea. And so starting to read your article about this sort of 300-mile pilgrimage driving around Turkey eating anchovies made me think, that's it. That this is sort of a manifestation of that.
Right.
So tell me about that. I mean, how did that come about? And then tell me about anchovies in Turkey, because it must be different than they are here.
Yeah. Well, I don't think I've actually eaten them here unless they've been preserved in oil or in salt. But I wasn't even aware really of anchovies in Turkey until maybe 2011, when for some reason we were in Istanbul and it was winter, and so it was anchovy season, and anchovies just suddenly seemed to be everywhere, and we started eating them and enjoying them. And a fishmonger in Kadıköy at the market in Istanbul said, hey, but if you like anchovies, you really need to go to the Black Sea. And so we were just there. We had an unplanned week, and so we just booked a ticket to the Black Sea, picked up a car and drove the length of it. And it was like anchovies were everywhere. It's a religion on the Black Sea, really, at this time in winter. People are grilling them. They're in bread. They're in stews. They're fried. They're dipped in cornmeal and fried. And people will eat them, you know, two or three times a day, even when they're in season. I mean, locals are just crazy for them. And so they were delicious. Because in the winter, Black Sea anchovies put on an extra layer of fat because it's so cold. But also it was just the joyous feeling of being, it just seemed like one big anchovy party. And so that gave me the idea for the article that I pitched to the Times. But I don't know what it is with anchovies. Maybe because they're so seasonal and they're so rare. And after that trip, when anchovies were everywhere, we did go back in subsequent years where there were hardly any anchovies because the seas were warm, because there were a lot of bonito, which they think eat anchovies. No one really knew why, but it was like, we went back one year and there was like no anchovies at all, and everyone was so sad.
I mean, you know, and I think there are more and more ingredients as we have moved to a place where we can get anything at any time. I mean, you mentioned tomatoes before, right? You can get, in New York, you can get pretty good tomatoes all year round. Yeah. They're not as great as the height of summer real field tomatoes, but you can still, you're not, it's not just like crunchy beefsteaks in the middle of winter anymore. But there are still things like anchovies and things that are so perishable that you just can't even do it. I mean, I hope that the anchovy populations have returned and that it was just some off years, but I fear, you know, that the seas are getting so overrun, you know, over harvested.
Yes, the Black Sea is, as a fishmonger on the Black Sea said to me, it's called the Black Sea, but it's really like a lake. So it's pollution and it's also overfishing. You know, we were there one year where they were pulling so many, these trawlers were pulling so many anchovies out of the sea that they had too many to sell, and they actually brought in a machine to the port in Sinop to grind the anchovies into feed, animal feed.
Right.
But these beautiful fresh anchovies, it was sad and alarming.
And then from an economic standpoint, the fishermen, if they have them, they aren't getting enough money for them, so it's sort
exactly.
of this unfortunate.
Yeah, and the industry employs a lot of off-season hazelnut farmers. And it's also a really big part of the culture in that on a certain part of the sea, there's a dance called the horun, which imitates the flailing of the anchovy when it's... I mean, it's
amazing.
It's really ingrained. And so you think, well, if anchovies disappear, what happens to this whole like slice of culture on the Black Sea? It's disturbing.
Yeah. Are there other things like the anchovy in Turkey where you kind of need to be in the right place at the right time?
Apricot season in Malatya. In that area around Malatya, which is in the southeast, apricots that taste the way I fleetingly remember them tasting when I was a kid. You know, it just seems like nowadays you get apricots, they don't taste like much. Just incredible. I think fall on the Black Sea in general is amazing because of the figs, the plums. People are making all these amazing pekmezes, which are fruit molasses. So you got fruit molasses made from cactus fruit, from figs, from mulberries, from plums, from rose hips, from cornelian cherries. It's just the Black Sea incredible in itself is a very bountiful part of Turkey. And so if you're there when things are in season. Oh, and another thing is in Van and Hakkari provinces on the Iran-Iraq borders, foraging is huge because there's not much arable land for farming. And in the spring, people just go nuts foraging all these wild herbs and vegetables that they dry or brine or pickle to add to a local cheese called Otlu Peyniri's herb cheese. And that's quite a like frenzied time too, with this sort of feeling of like we're celebrating a seasonal bounty and we're also stocking up for the rest of the year.
You have to work really hard to deal with it while you got it.
Yeah.
That's cool. Given the current political sort of uneasiness of that part of the world, is Turkey a place where people can still travel?
Absolutely. I mean, Istanbul is as, you know, safe as, you know, Brussels or Paris.
Sure.
I would travel to, we're planning to go back in January to eastern Turkey, maybe to Hatay province and hopefully to the Black Sea. sure, there is some political instability and you should pay attention to the news. Yeah. But you could certainly pick up a car and happily drive around the Aegean, the Mediterranean, into central Anatolia and sort of down to the southeast. And the Black Sea is completely, you know, doable.
Yeah.
I would say, go, it's anchovy season.
I've been to Crimea on the other side.
Oh, I'd love to go to Crimea. Yeah. Yeah, no, it's doable.
Cool. Well, I'll have to think about that. We like road trips in our family.
We do too.
My daughter's 8 and my son is almost 4, so maybe in a year or two and my son can stay up a little later.
But yeah, road trips are great.
Family road trip in Turkey.
That would be great.
On the horizon, that'd be really cool. If somebody had, say, 2 weeks in Southeast Asia and wanted to see like some of the places do you have favorites? I mean, it's so vast, and you've written so much about all these different places. That might be kind of an unfair question.
It's hard. People often send me an email with just that question because people do seem to only have 2 weeks. And a lot of times they want to do it all. So they, you know, they're putting in, like, plane trips and stuff. You know, I want to go to Taiwan, and I want to go to Thailand, and I want to go to Malaysia. And I just always say, pick one place and do it. Well and slow.
I think that's a great recommendation. I mean, it's so hard. I think that we get into this thing that, you know, you're going to be on at least a flight from the United States for 14, 15, 17 hours.
Yeah, and which takes a lot out of you.
It does. And you think, all right, I'm going to get here.
And I'm just going to hit the ground.
And I'm going to hit the ground. And there's so much I want to see, so I want to tick all the boxes.
Oh.
But I love your recommendation of just checking out a place.
Yeah, just go. And you know, pick an arrival city and a departure city. They may be the same or they may not. And leave your itinerary loose. Because even if you're going to, say, Thailand at the height of the season, you can still find places to stay. You can still rent a car at the last minute. You can still book a flight at the last minute, an internal flight or a train ticket. It's not like going to Europe in the summer where things are really tightly booked.
Right.
Sort of let, you know, to the extent that you can, keep your itinerary loose and go where your nose or your palate leads you. You could, you know, very happily spend 2 weeks in Bangkok and northern Thailand alone.
Right.
And just come away with a really, with a great experience, probably some extra poundage.
Yeah.
And a full, you know, a good understanding of like how people eat there and what the cuisine is like and what the variations of the cuisine are like. Don't try to do it all. It's impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I do find, you know, having traveled to Europe, in the 90s and then again in the early 2000s, it felt like it was well traveled. So I knew like, oh, well, you know, I'm going to be in London. I'm going to go to the Tate and I'm going to be in Paris. I'm going to go to the Louvre and I want to see the Musée d'Orsay and I want to, you know, see the gardens and I want to eat in this restaurant or at least go to the Marais and try and find a restaurant there, all these things. When I've traveled in Asia, mostly in Japan, I feel like I sort of try to leave it more open because I know whatever I find
is going to be good.
Yeah. And, even the most mediocre ramen that I've had in Tokyo is still as good or better than the ramen I can get here.
Oh,
so,
yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean,
and just the experience of walking around. I mean, that, you know.
Yeah. Give yourself time to just take things in and also to relax. I mean, there's nothing wrong with like taking the afternoon and having a nap in your hotel room if that's what appeals. It is vacation after all. It's not a competition sport.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And that's also a really good point. I think people definitely get into this sort of idea, especially with things like Instagram.
Or where, ticking things off. Yeah. You know, Anthony Bourdain ate here, and here, and I have to do that. No, it's fine. Just like go find your own noodles and they'll be great.
Yeah. And you might meet someone who invites you to their house or invites you to a party. Or
gives you a tip on a great place that no one else knows about.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
Well, thanks, Robin, so much. It's been wonderful talking with you.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So today, you just arrived in New York yesterday.
Yep.
And you're here for about a week, right?
Till Saturday.
Till Saturday,
in New York.
So not even quite. And so you have a couple of events. I know you have an event at MOFAD, at the Museum of Food and Drink, tonight.
We do have a MOFAD event tonight, and that's our only event in New York. And then until December 1st, with a break for Thanksgiving, we'll be traveling across the country doing a bunch of demos and cooking classes. David and I will be signing and doing presentations, and we have a couple special dinners planned with some restaurants. So
very cool. And then back, we didn't even get to talk about it, but we're basically out of time. And then back to Italy, where you now are living.
Yes, we moved to Italy in June after 20 years in Asia, and are enjoying it immensely.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.
And don't forget, please go immediately if you're, you know, when you're listening to this, wherever you are, and look at eatingasia.typepad.com. That is Robin's website, and it is incredible.
Thank you.
You can also look at istanbulandbeyondcookbook.com. You can follow Robin on Twitter at eatingasia and Instagram at istanbulandbeyond.
Exactly. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to David Tatasciore for engineering. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to like the show on iTunes, and you can reach out to me if you have any questions, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com, and you can follow me on social media, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.